It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 218, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, Eclipse, Pay with Palm, Discord chatting, pins that are not quite Star Trek.
Hey, Gary, we're finally back.
Yeah, a lot of travel and real life getting in the way and stuff.
I was just going to say, it's not like it was a coordinated effort to be gone for a month. It's just happened in weekly stages.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
And one of those, excuses was the eclipse.
Right. Yeah. So, like most of America, but not people from your corner of the country, I got to see the eclipse. And I'm not talking about like see it like everybody, you know, most people did. I traveled to the zone of totality.
Yes.
Bit of a drive. It's a 12-hour drive. The closest point is roughly Texas, even though it looks like it should be further north because the angle of the zone, the further north it went, the further east it went. So kind of like hitting Texas was made sense, and it worked out great because I have a friend that lives almost exactly at that point.
Cool. Yeah.
But you know, all those clouds, right? I mean, so many people I know went to Texas because Texas historically has, you know, supposed to be the best weather that time of year. And so everybody made plans to go to Texas. I even had friends that made plans and went to Mexico, where it should have even had a better chance of being clear. But as the day approached, of course, lots of clouds were forecast. I almost canceled. I mean, I was I got a rental car to do the drive, the drive. And it was down to the last hour before I had to pick up the rental car. I just made the decision just to go for it.
Right.
But it looked like it was going to be cloudy.
Well, I do remember that, you reminded me that we'd had to cancel this, this recording last week. And I responded by, hope it all goes well. And your response was simply a series of 5 cloud emojis and a crying face emoji. So I was really concerned.
Yeah, because I mean, it was supposed to be cloudy. There was supposed to be high clouds and low clouds. And sure enough, when I got there, I was in a large town north of Dallas called Frisco. I mean, really a suburb of Dallas. And the forecast up to the last minute was like from the middle of Dallas south, it was supposed to be pretty solid clouds, but north of Dallas, maybe partially cloudy. And as the morning turned into the afternoon, we experienced these super low clouds that were moving super fast. And they were just, it would be like a minute of cloud cover and a minute where there was a hole and you could see the sun, and then another minute of cloud cover. And when the eclipse started, and you just had the partial eclipse, it was good because you were able to get, you can't just take continuous pictures. You can't take like 1,000 pictures going up. So there would be a clear spot. I take a picture and then I lose the sun for a minute or two. And then I take another picture and then but the next, piece was taken out of it. And it, just went on and on and on. And he just started to get so nervous when totality came, because it's like, are we just going to get hit with a big cloud and miss it or what? And just as it was like a sliver, a huge blue patch of sky opened up. And these are really low clouds. So we're talking about like the specific block that we're on. I mean, really, if you just go a few blocks over, everything shifts, right? So we just experienced from this one backyard a complete several minute blue patch right at the moment of totality, and got to see the whole thing. And it was fantastic. And I got to correct all the mistakes I made back in 2017 when I took horrible photos. And I actually was able to get my best photo, which, was the camera perfectly manually focused. And everything, solar flares are visible that people got. Basically, I got the best picture I think I possibly could have gotten given my camera and my lens, because I didn't really have a telephoto. I had something less. I had like a zoom, right? So it was okay. But if you look at the full frame, the sun is just a portion of it. It's maybe like 10% of the whole thing. A telephoto lens, a good one, I would have filled
Right.
Right. You know, the whole thing with the sun and the moon. But yeah, so given my lens, given the camera, which is, it was a Canon Rebel T3i from 15 years ago. More than 15, 17 years ago, I don't know. Given that, I got the best picture possible. So the next step up for the next eclipse is to actually get a better camera and a telescope lens of some sort.
2045, I think you have to be prepared for.
Yeah. Or travel, right? I mean, the thing is 24/5 is the next one across the US. And I don't know if I'm, now I've seen two total eclipses. Both were breathtaking, and it makes me want to go see another one before 2045. I don't think I'd go and say, I'm going to travel for this one, but I think if I was thinking of a vacation and, you know, for a certain year, for the 2030, 2032, whatever, you know, and I would look at where eclipses were and say, you know, maybe I can convince my wife that this is the year that we go to, you know, wherever. And we just happen to do it during that week, and we just happen to be there. But the next eclipse does actually pass just south of me in 2045.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, actually the path of totality is 1 mile south of me. Like literally, like places I go, like I walk to get lunch are in the path of totality, but not where I live.
So, but what that means though, is that you're going to be at what, 99.9% totality?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, but I mean, bottom line is, of course, I don't need to worry about where to stay or anything like that. And since it is passing through the middle of Colorado, which is very much empty, there are plenty of places that I could go to watch it, including the top of Pikes Peak, which would probably be the place to be if it wasn't for the fact there's only like 100 parking spaces up there.
Well, and there'll be a thousand people up there at the same time.
I mean, I'm sure you would have to, they're going to have to do something to limit the number of cars trying to go up, but nobody can stop you from hiking up it. So,
correct.
Yeah. You know, but I'll be 75. So I don't think I'll be hiking up Pikes Peak. I think I'll probably watch it from some pasture nearby. Anyway, yeah, it was a great experience. I got great pictures, got the solar flares. So you could see one of the solar flares was visible with the naked eye, and my friend and I were commenting on it. We were like, what is that at the bottom? And for some reason, it didn't occur to me that there would be solar flares. We just thought about reflections on craters or, an indentation that was a crater on the moon or something like that happening. And then, of course, as soon as it was over and I glanced at the news to see like, oh, how did other places fare? You know, I saw the headline saying solar flares erupt during totality. I was like, that's what it was.
That's very cool. I'm looking at the picture you put in our shared document, and it's a very good picture. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can see at least two significant solar flares in it.
Yep. So anyway, that was really cool. Got to use all my tech. The funny thing is that all the mistakes I made using my Canon back in 2017, so I didn't get any good photos. I didn't repeat any of those, and the Canon worked great. But now I also had a Sony mirrorless, and I had that on a tripod next to it. And I basically didn't get anything from that because I was so focused on getting the Canon to do everything right.
Sure.
That I didn't get the Sony setup. It's tricky because you have 2 hours on either end where you're taking things with a solar filter, which is a whole set of settings, right? And then you have to pull that filter off as soon as totality and basically take, raw. Yeah, I mean, just take them with just the raw lens.
Right.
Whereas the Sony, I didn't have a solar filter for. So it basically sat there with the lens cap on to protect it during all of it. And then I took the lens cap off, and there was just no way in those few minutes that I was going to be able to set it up and get it working right.
Looks like you made the right choice from my perspective. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. And most important camera, my own eyes is what got to see it the whole time. Cause thanks to the clouds being very kind to us.
It's interesting because, I have mixed feelings making the effort to take photos of the solar eclipse, because there are now millions of what boil down to the exact same photograph. And I mean, as a photographer myself, I so get it, right? Mm-hmm. I absolutely, I would break out my, uh, See, I've got a 300 millimeter. That's my longest that I would absolutely set up, probably much like you did, and do my best. But on the other hand, you know, it's like I said, it's the same photo that everybody else is taking. They'll show up in the newspaper the next day.
Right.
What's the real point? As opposed to, you know, sitting back in a lawn chair and just watching.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was jealous of people that did that because, like, I would see, I was just in a friend's backyard, right? So there were four of us at the moment, right, in totality back there. And whereas opposed to in 2017, I was on a road and it was like a crowd of people stretching as far as I could see. I saw pictures of people down in Mexico. It was like a beach and everybody was in those lawn chairs and everybody was just sitting and relaxing and watching it. And you saw a few tripods with cameras.
Right.
But most people, you could see all these people that had no camera on them at all. And they were just reclining in a chair, looking up at totality. And I was like, wow, I'm kind of jealous because, I mean, they've got it, you know, no pressure. You just sit back, just enjoy it. You know, I think that's that might be the way to do it. I'm saying that might be the way to do it in the future, but I know very well if I ever see another total solar eclipse, I'm probably going to have a bucket load of camera equipment with me and try to do the same thing. It's just, it's the techie in me, you know, I want to do this.
Yeah. And I, like I said, I totally get it. The combination of tech and photography, it's like, I can't not take a picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, cool. I'm glad you got lucky on that one. I'm really glad that turned out for you.
Yeah.
Cool. So I ran into an interesting article over here in local news. I've not grabbed the actual article. I've actually pointed to the site or the page on Amazon that talks about this. It's called Amazon One. And we talk a lot about how biometrics is being used to do things like unlock your phone and unlock your PC and other kinds of things like that. This is an interesting one, especially in the light of the fact that Amazon recently, as in like in the past few weeks, announced or closed all of their walkout stores.
Mm-hmm.
By that, those stores were the stores where you could grab what you needed and walk out the door. And you would somehow, they would figure out who you were and how much you owed, and it would just get billed, of course, to your Amazon account. Those are getting closed down. But what they're doing elsewhere, and apparently they're doing it in more of their mainstream stores, apparently I have to go to my local Whole Foods to activate this thing, is essentially a palm reader. So what you do is you set it up on your phone. I had to very carefully take a couple of pictures of my palm using the Amazon One app. And then presumably that would identify me as I shop at, you know, at Whole Foods and other Amazon One enabled retail outlets. Essentially, it's the last step. You don't even have to have your phone with you anymore, right? You and I have both commented on the fact that we're not carrying nearly as many credit cards as perhaps we may have in the past, because all we really need to do is tap our phone. And we're done, right? In fact, I did it earlier today, paying for some groceries. But this removes even that. Once you've got your palm figured out and captured somehow, all you do, and you don't even have to put it on the glass. It's a case of, at least the pictures they show are people just holding their hand above the scanner. So, and they did have me scan both palms, so I could do it, I suppose, left-handed or right-handed. I just thought it was interesting. And I'm very interested to see what the uptake is on this, because I think that there's a lot of squirreliness for people around biometrics in general.
Right.
They're coming to accept face recognition. They're coming to accept fingerprint ID. Not everybody, of course, but certainly, you know, devices like Apple's equipment and even many of the Android phones and so forth, they're all basically enabling this kind of stuff. More and more people are getting used to it. I just find it interesting. I'm looking forward to activating it and just seeing how reliable it is. I don't know. I was just curious if you had any thoughts, if you had heard about it yet.
No, but I think it's available at there's an Ideal Market that's a few blocks from where I live. Ideal Market is like a mini Whole Foods. Matter of fact, I think it's ideal market by Whole Foods, or it says Whole Foods on the side.
Oh, that makes
or
sense.
something. Yeah. And it's like a little neighborhood thing. Like they've got, the little deli area, and you can get sandwiches and coffee and stuff like that. And then you've got a few aisles of basic groceries, and stuff. And then a whole bunch of stuff going on in the front, more Amazon products, a lot of Amazon branding everywhere. And then the checkouts, mainly there's like two or three regular checkouts. And then there's all the self-checkout stuff. And the self-checkout stuff has all this tech that I basically ignore and then just use Apple Pay. But the tech has to do with like Amazon stuff, like entering in your Amazon account or something on your phone with the app, and then it knows your account and you could just pay. So I could just pay basically like I'm making a purchase on Amazon, like using the app. And I think there's some biometrics there, but I haven't really looked closely into it. I mean, it almost seems to me like at this point, it's more they continue to experiment. Like they want to do this thing with the Palm, they want to do other ways to pay through, Amazon and still use Apple Pay and still accept PayPal and all of these other things. And I don't know. I think they're throwing it all out there. It's one of the reasons why Amazon has, Whole Foods and their own Amazon stores. There's one of those, not about 2 miles from me. There's an Amazon store where you can buy books and like tech gadgets and stuff. And you have Ideal Markets, and it's just they want to be able to quickly test things like palm reading for to see. I mean, maybe I don't know. It's kind of the AirPods effect. AirPods were like a weird thing that Apple came out with that somehow 2 years later became the norm in earphones, right? And it's like nobody wants to miss out on that. And Amazon's thinking like, what's the chance people are going to want to pay with their palms? Probably pretty low. But if it turns out that's it, we didn't want to pass on this, right? So let's do it. And if it fails, it'll fail for us instead of us maybe missing out and it turning out that other stores, Starbucks gets the jump on everybody, and now everybody pays with Starbucks points for everything because palm reading was the way to go. So yeah, I like Amazon has a mindset of not being afraid to experiment with things, like
I
their
have to admit,
stores and
I
stuff.
kind of like the concept. I mean, obviously, it's based on the fact that, like, just like fingerprints, your palms are unique to you. I think that it's the classic case of, will they let the experiment run long enough for it to return relevant results? Because I suspect that this is one of those things that will probably have a relatively slow uptake. There will be obviously early adopters like us, but the real proof is in the when you see, like in the case of the AirPods, when you see people jogging out in front of your house and you know that they're not techies but they're wearing AirPods, you know that that's succeeded. When that starts to happen in the grocery store environment for random people paying with their palm, we'll see. I mean, it's a godsend for people who leave their wallets everywhere.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it is the weird thing that now that it's like it's you could use it without your phone, but why would you be there without your phone in the first place? But maybe that's not the, maybe the point is to leave your phone in your pocket. I mean, after all, Apple makes a big deal out of with Apple Pay to leave your phone in your pocket, use your Apple Watch, right? Which I'm doing more and more now. I'm trying to remember to not just grab my phone, but just use my watch to do Apple Pay. And it's like, well, I mean, what's the point of that? My phone's always with me. Well, obviously there is some point. It is a little easier. Maybe Amazon wants to do it, but they're not successful with anything like a watch. So they're like, well, we'll just skip that. We'll go, you leave the phone in your pocket and you don't have to have anything,
For some reason, it reminds me of the old adage, the old entrepreneurial adage, make it easy for people to give you money. And not that there's a whole lot of friction between, whipping out your phone and tapping it on the device, but it removes just a little bit more friction to making the payment.
No, definitely. You always want to look for, I mean, so maybe that's it. Maybe it doesn't have to be like the way people pay, as long as it's a way people
Anyway,
pay,
we'll see. Well, gosh knows Let's see, have they actually removed any ways to pay in the last 10 years, aside from this walkout experiment? I mean, you can still pay with a paper check, you can still pay with cash, you can still pay by inserting a credit card, you can still pay by tapping a credit card, you can tap your phone. There's lots of options for people.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of any major way that they've removed. I suppose you say you can still pay by check for things, and I suppose that's true. If there was ever a candidate for removing
Oh yeah,
that,
absolutely.
remove that. Yeah, I've never done that. Like, I don't think I ever bought anything in the store my entire life
Really?
with a check. And
Wow.
it's not like I'm that young where I could say,
Right.
well, it's just not. I lived through a period where lots of people did that, right?
Yeah.
And I just never did that. I paid either with cash or with a credit card, or debit card. Never brought a check to pay in a store for
Fascinating. Yeah,
something. Yeah.
I wrote checks for years and years and years, even paying bills with writing by writing a check, that kind
Well,
of
I
stuff.
paid bills. Yeah. That's what I primarily had my checkbook for. And I
Okay.
still have my checkbook for because occasionally it comes
No.
up. But I still can't figure a good
So
way to send money to somebody by mail that isn't tech oriented on the other side.
my solution to that problem is to use my bank's bill paying service. So it's basically all online for me, and then they will physically cut and mail a check, a paper check, to the recipient.
Yeah, I've done that. I think it, I don't know, maybe your bank offers that for free. Mine
Yes.
doesn't.
Okay.
Mine has a $15 charge per month for it, which I happily paid back in the days before all the auto pay started,
Yes.
where, I could just, so I was doing auto pay. I was just doing it through my bank and I was sending off, a dozen
Yes.
checks a month. And I was like, $15, sure, take my money. But then when it got down to I wasn't using it anymore, and I go months without using it at all, I kind of removed that from my account. And I know that, the funny thing is I talked to somebody the other day, or I heard somebody saying something about how oh yeah, it was somebody I was talking to, and that they don't use auto pay at all for anything. And it was because of this feeling of like, I don't want any of these companies that I don't trust, energy company, the landlord, that nobody, I don't want any of them be able to take money from my account, which was weird. And I was like, well, I've done everything that way for the last 10 years
Yep.
and never had a problem. So, I'm sure
Yeah,
there's
and it's
multiple
one way
sides of
to
that.
make sure you never forget a payment.
Yeah, you never forget a payment. You have receipts and control. You could see everything, and you could do cool stuff like for things that vary, which, they can take the right amount every month and all that. I don't know. I mean, I guess I see the point of not trusting big corporations, but it's like I don't know. I feel they're out to get us in more legitimate ways than actually withdrawing like the wrong amount.
Yes.
It's like big companies will steal from us in much more cunning ways than actually doing something that we can recognize as stealing.
Right.
So, anyway.
All right. We interrupt this podcast for a public service announcement. This is something I'm sure you run across as well. Maybe you don't, actually, in the Apple ecosystem, you'll have to tell me. Please, everyone, do something that auto-uploads photos from your phone. After you take them, while you're on the internet, whatever. It's just something so that if you take a picture and then lose your phone, you haven't lost all of the photos on your phone. And the reason I bring this up is that it keeps happening. I keep hearing from people who have lost a phone or their phone dies or who knows, something goes on. And all of a sudden, they're not as worried about the phone as they are about all the pictures that they had on it that are now also gone. I find that difficult in today's environment just because there are so many solutions to the problem. But apparently, Not everybody's taking advantage of all those solutions, and I want people to take advantage of at least one of those solutions. Now, the reason I was curious about the iPhone ecosystem is that are you automatically hooked into iCloud when you start taking pictures on your iPhone, or is that something you have to like enable?
You're kind. It is kind of the default, I think. If you were just to buy a new iPhone, sign up for an Apple ID, and start taking pictures, I think you're prompted. But I think the defaults are to yes, use iCloud Photos, and I think most people, especially younger people today, just go with that.
Right.
And so there's much less of a problem than there used to be, but it's definitely still a problem, especially people that just simply do not want to use iCloud for whatever reason, because they still believe certain things about the cloud or
the
whatever.
Cloud, yes,
Yeah,
the evil
I
cloud. Yep.
Fight against it. And then I hear every once in a while from people that are like, oh, I think it's time I tried to move some of my photos from my iPhone to my Mac. What's the best way to do it? I'm like, you haven't been doing that so far. It's like, at least do it. Like, if you're not going to do the cloud thing, at least be syncing your iPhone to your Mac, which is the old fashioned way of doing it, on a regular basis. So your photos are off your, they don't just exist on your iPhone. And it makes me really nervous. I think one of the reasons it's not as bad on the Mac side of things is because, we went in the Apple ecosystem from the iPod to the iPhone, and the iPod established this whole, like, connect your iPod to your Mac,
right? Right.
Do this syncing. And that's how you update like the songs that are on your iPod. And then we went to the phone, and it was like your phone is now, it's like a phone and an iPod, and you still do the same syncing. It worked exactly the same way. It was the same interface.
Right.
And in addition to the phone having music on it, it had photos on it. Matter of fact, there were even iPods that had cameras before there was the phone. So the people got the idea early on, before there was iCloud, that you synced your iPhone to your Mac for all sorts of various things, and that would automatically pull the pictures in. So the cloud just made that irrelevant, and you didn't have to do it anymore. It still happens. It's scary to think of. I find it scary just not using iCloud for even like being out somewhere, like on a hiking trip. You're not in service range.
Right.
And then I start to think, as I'm hiking back, it's like, boy, I haven't been all day. I've been, I haven't been connected to the internet, which means all the photos I took are just on this phone right now. And then it's like I get back in the car and I'm driving, and I'm like, oh, I've been connected for a little while. Okay, my photos are safe. Even going back to the eclipse, I remember when it was over and not being able to stop until the eclipse was completely over, because I wanted to get, partials all the way through.
Right.
And then be having this weird feeling about this SD card that was in my camera.
Oh, yeah.
And being like, I want to get, it was like the first thing I did was get the SD card out of there, put it directly, not let it leave my hand until it went into an SD card reader, hooked
right
up to my Mac, and downloaded all the photos. And there were raw photos. So the, even over, USB 3, it was like still taking a while. I was like, come on, get to the totality already as it's loading each one in. And then they were all there. And then, of course, plugging my Mac in and just, okay, it's syncing to iCloud. Good. Just let it go. It'll be a few minutes, and then everything will be up in iCloud, and it'll be safe.
Yep, I understand. Anyway, it's funny. The other problem that I don't hear about as much, but it was something that I certainly run into from time to time. I don't know how many of the other synchronization services you use, but I happen to use Dropbox and OneDrive and Google Drive and Proton Drive and something else. There's a few others running around. And what's really interesting is that many of them, when you install their mobile app, they all offer to back up your pictures, which means if you're not careful, every time you take a picture, you could be uploading like the same picture four or five times into four or five different cloud storage things. So that's kind of like the opposite problem, a little bit of overkill, but it does mean that, if you're not comfortable with iCloud, are you comfortable with Dropbox? Are you comfortable with Google? Are you comfortable with any of these others that potentially have the same kind of app and the same kind of functionality? Use one of those.
Right.
Anyway, that's our PSA for the week.
Cool. So there was an article, I think it was about a week ago. I'm pretty sure you read it as well.
I'm
not a big reader of the New York Times, but for some reason, when I went to read this article, because I saw it was linked from somewhere, and then later a friend recommended it, I was able to read the whole thing. So I think maybe you get one article a month or something like that. I don't
something
know.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. So and it turned out not only is it an interesting story that pertains to the whole, you know, tech enthusiast thing, but it was actually a really well-written article that made you want to read the whole thing. That was cool. So it was a story.
Bonus.
Yeah, it was a story about a guy who he has 24,000 songs on Spotify. And so the deal is that he writes and records on the fly, basically albums and albums worth of songs, just uploads them constantly. He's gone for volume. He's the one person going for quantity, right? And it's an interesting story. I don't want to spoil it, but you know, it's like some of his stuff are songs he just makes up, and sometimes there are albums where he just sings people's names over and over again, with the idea being that if that happens to be your name, it's fun to find a song on there, or maybe it's your friend's name. It's fun to find a song with that name just sung over and over again. It's like your own little custom theme song. And he'll just have albums filled with just the same song, but with different names sung, or different little themes and all sorts of just weird things, ideas he comes up with to just create all these songs. And since it's all digital, he can just record them, add them to his Spotify library. He's got lots of different accounts, different like pseudo bands that he creates. It's really fascinating. And when I first started reading it, I thought, oh, so this guy, he must just get up in the morning and just set a goal of recording like 100 songs or whatever. And then that's it. That's the end of his day. Just like I record my Mac most videos, and you know, it's like, okay, and then I'm done and now I can kind of relax. But in fact, he actually creates movies and does a couple podcasts and takes like extremely long walks in the woods and does all these things. So it became a really fascinating read to find out about how he does this and how it's been kind of successful, because every once in a while, one of the songs gets a lot of plays, or it's just a lot of plays over having all of these, you know, songs on Spotify and other streaming services. So if you're interested in all about internet content, you know, follow the link in our show notes.
Yeah, I've heard it referred to as the audio version of the long tail, where you're not going for a single big hit, but you're going through a bunch of stuff that may individually not get you a lot of traffic, but in aggregate, it adds up.
Yeah, no, it adds up and it makes sense. But I was surprised actually, when I looked at some of the songs, that they're the ones that are just repetitive, like the same name and stuff, but they're also a whole bunch of collections, just odd songs about different topics, and they all seem to be different. Like it seems like he's just really, you know, it's like they're writers that could just keep writing. I mean, well, we call them journalists that could write something different every day. He
right.
seems like he actually, you know, can make these different songs. He's not taking your song and then changing a few words and re-recording it. He's actually just coming up with a song on the fly, and like an improv song. And they're not good. They're not horrible.
Right.
They're just songs. So it was fascinating. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. One of the things I wanted to mention is that, gosh, a few years ago, I tried setting up my own Discord server with the hopes that it could be a perk, if you will, for some of my patrons or whatever. And we had a few people get signed up, and eventually nobody was there. It was crickets. It was me talking to myself. So I shut it down. But I didn't really get rid of it, right? I just stopped promoting it and stopped posting to it or whatever. Anyway, a couple of weeks ago, I decided, you know what the heck? One of the things that's changed over the last several years is that Discord has risen in popularity dramatically, actually. It's getting a lot more visibility in a lot of different areas. It started out, of course, as a way for gamers to be able to chat with one another while they were playing games. But it is now not unlike what I was trying to do, often a perk of becoming a patron of a particular person or service or whatever, or in some cases, just knowing about them. There are people, individuals, groups, whatever, that have Discord servers that are associated with them that anybody can join. And I just thought that was an interesting model. So I decided to fire it up again. For those that are so interested, especially if you're already spending a lot of time on Discord, go.askleo.com/discord is the invite to my server. The other realization I made is that I realized that I'm running Discord all the time anyway, myself. I'm a member of something like 15 different Discord servers, even though I only pay attention to one or two. And if I'm going to have it sitting there, I might as well be willing to respond to people that reach out via that method. So anyway, I don't know if you've tried anything like that in the past. You, of course, are certainly welcome to join my Discord. But I just thought it was an interesting, another experiment to try and see how well it resonates these days. Like I said, the landscape has changed somewhat.
Yeah, I'm actually trying out something now. It's not Discord. Patreon has started their own thing, and they just call it chats. And so it's on Patreon. It's set up where you could say, you know, people above this tier have access to it and all of that.
Right, right.
And they've had it for a while, but it was only in their app. So you had to do it in their app. You couldn't do it on the web. Then I got into they started rolling out a beta of the web version of it. And I got into that. And now they've actually finished the beta. So it's available to all Patreon creators. And it's, you know, I've set up a bunch of different I try to make it like Discord. You know, there's like a place to chat about, like if you have a question, there's a place to chat about rumors. There's a place to chat about, I don't think I did the rumors thing. I think I did like, oh, the current video. There's a place to chat about how I make the videos, that kind of thing. And so it's just a different place for people to go and ask questions rather than having to respond as a comment to something.
Right.
So anyway, I've got it going, and it gets some traffic. I haven't really been pushing it too much. I'm kind of afraid to push it because I kind of feel like if I do, it'll become a little unmanageable for me as the only person on, you know, it's like me on the one end, everybody else on the other. And so if like I got too many questions in a day, suddenly it would be this thing, it would take up all my time. So yeah, it's interesting. I have thought about either experimenting with my own Discord, also experimenting with my own version of the Activity Pub or whatever, you know, the way to send out to Mastodon and all that. You know, so I have my own basic, you know, Twitter-like social media network that goes out to various services. So yeah, I've thought about stuff like that, but I haven't got a chance to play with it.
It's interesting. For many of the Discord servers that I'm a member of, it's often a Discord server that is focused on a single person, an internet influencer or celebrity, quote unquote celebrity or whatever. And, you know, there's lots of people chatting there. And the actual person that the Discord server is about isn't there most of the time. They drop in periodically. Sometimes they have channels that are specifically targeted at the various levels of patronage that they may support. So there'd be, you know, anybody can join this, but if you're a patron, let me know and I'll assign you to this channel so you can chat to, you know, along with only the other patrons. But I think that there's a sense that certainly once you reach a kind of a, I don't want to call it a critical mass, but I'll just say that the negative stigma of not being on your own Discord server isn't as high as one might think. I think it would be different for Patreon. I agree. If you set up a Patreon chat and you're not there, that probably does feel a little icky. But Discord, at least from what I've seen, the zen so far of most Discord servers is a little different. I also noted that Substack also set up the same kind of a thing, where if you sign up for somebody's Substack newsletter, depending on, again, whether or not you pay for it, they can configure it for everybody or not. But there is also a chat capability, so you could chat with other readers and the writer as well. And same thing, the reason that I brought that to mind is that they too started out with the chat being available only in the mobile app, which made it basically a non-starter for me, since I'm basically at my desktop all day. Mm-hmm. But eventually ended up rolling it out to the desktop as well. So that's interesting. I don't find myself using it a lot, but it is another interesting way. I think, much like all of the things we've been talking about, these are all things worth experimenting with to see mm-hmm. if they are something that appeals to people. Once again, making sure to give it enough of a trial so that the results, the interest or lack of interest, is statistically significant.
Cool. One last story that we kind of need to talk about because we've been on break for so long. And we won't be having an episode next week, by the way. So,
I don't think we've talked about AI yet today, have we?
We haven't, but we're going to. But not AI so much, really, because a big story for tech enthusiasts for the last couple of weeks has been this humane AI pin, mm-hmm. right? And I think the only reason it's really getting a lot of attention is because it's so unique as a gadget. It's not. Right. It's not like something that's already out there. Basically, if you haven't seen this thing, and neither you or I have seen or played with it, right. but we've just read the reviews and stuff. It's this little pin that you clip to your shirt, actually magnetically clips to your shirt. And it has no screen, really, kind of. Has a microphone, it's got a camera and a speaker. And it's kind of this cloud device where you touch it and then you could ask it a question, and it acts like kind of like Siri or Alexa or Google, but it's hooked up to AI. So I think it's hooked up to ChatGPT. I don't know. And you could ask a question. You could ask it questions, and you could ask it to do some assistant like things like record a reminder, that kind of thing. It's meant to be basically an alternative to a phone, right? It's hooked to your shirt, not a phone in your pocket. It doesn't have the screen. It does have this thing where there's a projector, and it can project onto your hand like a monochrome little display. Mm-hmm. And not only can project onto your hand, but it can react to gestures. So you can close and open your hand, move your hand back and forth, and kind of turn your hand in different ways, and it will allow you to do some control. So it's got a visual component that's kind of unique. I like the idea. I hear the implementation is horrible. Like, it doesn't, it's not very useful. But I like that somebody's experimenting with this and saying, here's something that's like an unphone. It's a very different kind of thing to have with you. And it seems like a lot of the things the reviewers are complaining about, like the normal request that you can ask of your phone or do on your phone, it just says, I can't do that, or I don't know how to do that, or there's no way for me to do that, which makes it frustrating. It's stuff that could be fixed with the same hardware.
Right.
It could just become better over time. And this is just a starting point. It's kind of fascinating. Look up. I mean, there's tons of YouTube reviews of this thing. It's worth seeing a YouTube video of somebody using it and talking about it, because it'll give you an idea of, this is one of those devices where it's going to be like, this device isn't going to be a hit. Maybe a future version of it is, or maybe parts of it are going to start showing up in regular devices, like regular phones and smartwatches and such.
What I found interesting earlier this morning was seeing somebody refer to it as a Star Trek comm badge.
Yeah.
In the sense that that's exactly how you use it from the TNG series. You tap it and you talk to it. It's not a communications device, but it could be, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's another easily. Piece.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I'm surprised actually didn't try and make part of it. It's also a little bit bigger than you want it to be, I think, but it's not horrid. But I suspect for it to be truly, if for it to eventually be successful, it's going to have to be both smaller and probably more visually appealing, because at that point you're wearing it like jewelry. And, you just don't want anything pinned to your chest. I found it interesting. Yeah, you're right. And I'm disappointed, of course, that the reviews coming out are that it's really a poor implementation, poor performance, I guess, is the big thing. It's using ChatGPT. I don't know which model, but it's using ChatGPT. But apparently it can take, like 10 seconds to get a response to a ChatGPT question, which is just, that's a non-starter for something you're wearing like that.
Yeah.
I found it interesting. What also tickled me is that it actually, for the past few years, I have been looking for a device not unlike this, where essentially all I really want is a voice recorder that I can tap, talk, and tap again to turn it off, so that I can just record random ideas that come to me as they do, because if I don't record them, I will absolutely lose them. And of course, those will be the million-dollar ideas that I'll have forgotten. So and I've got voice recorders, and right now I'm relying on an app on my phone that's pretty much the closest thing I can, but it's still a little bit difficult and cumbersome to use, especially when I'm driving. Some years ago, 2, maybe 3 years ago, there was a Kickstarter for a device that essentially clipped to your collar and worked very much like this. It was called a Sendstone. I paid enough in the Kickstarter to get one. And same thing has happened here. The idea is awesome. If it worked, I would be all in on it, but I could never, ever get it to work reliably or usefully. So I don't even know where it is right now. I think it's down with my my box of to be recycled electronics kind of stuff. But again, it's same idea. Something you wear, you interact with it very, very easily, and it provides some useful functionality, or at least it should. And if it did, I'd be using it a lot more.
Yep. So
I'm hopeful that the next version of the Humane, which is an interesting name, by the way, that the next version of the Humane pin or some future version of it will either, iron out a lot of the problems that it's been running into.
Yeah, no, I definitely think so. And I mean, to me, I look at it and there's a little bit of like trying to compare it with my Apple Watch, and trying to figure, oh, it's a different form factor. It's on the wrist instead of on the shirt. And there's a lot of different things, but there's a lot I could simulate. I can customize my Apple Watch to do a lot of things. Like I can add a button on the main screen that does what you said, record a voice memo. And I could also add I don't think I can do it yet, but there's a ChatGPT app for the iPhone. I'm sure for Android as well. Mm-hmm. That's not only you can talk to it and it'll talk back to you, but you can configure it to make it really quickly using a shortcut. I have set the action button on the side of my iPhone 15 Pro to actually go into the app and immediately start listening. So all I need to do is hold that button for a second and then talk. And now I'm using ChatGPT. Now, if I customize ChatGPT a little bit more, I could get a little bit closer to what Humane is doing, but not exactly there.
Right.
And you would think you'd be able to do that with the Apple Watch, but it's not quite there yet. But you could easily see how it could be. So, there's a lot of crossover here. Phones, watches, this pin, I guess this is going to be, these are called pins, AI pins or something like that. It is interesting to think of that if they came up with this device like 2 years ago, they probably would have called it like a pin. But now it's called an AI pin. Because AI's got to be in front of everything.
AI's everywhere.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I mean, if they're using AI in the way they describe it, it actually is a much, a big step above the Sendstone that I was describing, right? It's an opportunity to get it to do some more things.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, speaking of cool, you just said, what's cool?
So last night we finished Fallout. on Amazon Prime.
Yep.
I've never played the game, so I do not have that as a frame of reference, but I learned long ago not to associate games with their cinematic equivalents too strongly. You're only going to be led to disappointment, which is why I've played a little bit of Halo, and I loved Halo, the series, and I know that they're not the same thing. I understand that there are a lot of pedants out there that are a little upset by some of the differences. Anyway, Fallout. Fallout, the word, if you're not familiar with it, it is literally about nuclear fallout. That's the theme, is that this is a post-apocalyptic society after a nuclear war devastates at least the United States, if not more. There's a lot going on, a lot of intrigue, a lot of surprises along the way. There are great actors. I love Walton Goggins. He's in multiple different things lately. And he plays a very, very interesting character. It's just, like I said, it's good storytelling. It's an interesting story to be told. The visuals are great. We're just having a good time with it. And we are, of course, they've left it wide open for season two. There's 8 episodes in season one. It's wide open for season two. They haven't committed to it yet, but they'd be silly not to, because it's been getting a lot of good reviews, a lot of view time. And so, yeah, Fallout. I loved it. If you're into post-apocalyptic sci-fi, it's a keeper.
Yep, I've started it, so I'm not done.
Good, I didn't spoil anything for you. Yay.
Nope. Hey, it's been this show came out several weeks ago, but it's been that long since we did a show. There's, of course, the Three Body Problem, the Netflix version. I did actually talk about it, and it wasn't Eden Cool from a few months ago, the Three Body Chinese TV show.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure I probably talked about Three Body, the series, which is actually called A Remembrance of Earth's Past or something like that. The sci-fi books, the yes. epic sci-fi novels. So this is the Netflix version, and it's basically the Game of Thrones guys. Right.
Yep.
Game of Thrones guys are in charge of this. And it's 8 episodes as well. It's on Netflix. It is interesting because the books are long and very detailed. The TV show, the Chinese TV show, 30 episodes that barely gets through a chunk of the first book. Very detailed. This is 8 episodes and it flies. Right.
Right.
And at first I was like, I had whiplash because it was going so fast. It was like, oh, the first episode just covered so much, you know? But by the end, I have to say that once I adjusted to the pacing, I kind of enjoyed it. It's like, oh, okay. They are getting stuff in here. It is all making sense.
Oh,
yeah, there are parts that they left out, but I'm sure that's true of Game of Thrones as well. And I kind of like went from like, lukewarm when I started watching it to, by the time I was done the season, I was like, oh no, I think they did a good job. I can't wait till season two, and they continue the story. And it's gotten a lot of people talking about the story, which of course expands its audience quite a bit. And I think hopefully it'll get a lot of people reading those books, because they're very good.
What I think people reading the books will be surprised is that the big difference between the book, I've only read the first book, but the book and the Netflix series, is that they have loosely changed the setting. It starts in China, because of, you know, many of the important plot points begin there. But they very quickly move it to, you know, essentially a, I want to say a world independent, but more of a American background.
Well, actually, British. People. I mean, really, it's because it takes place mostly in Britain.
I think that's a little jarring for people that have only read the book.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Or the opposite, of course. If people have seen the show and then go and read the book, they'll realize that it's quite different in some interesting ways. But yes, we too watched it and enjoyed it. And as I went into it, I was wondering how they would do certain things. And they did a very reasonable job of you know, visualizing some of the concepts that I thought were going to be interesting to actually bring to the screen. So they did a good job.
Yep. Cool. All right.
Blatant.
Blatant self-promotion.
Blatant self-promotion. So the one I want to point people at this week is a question I get all the time. I mean, as long as I've been doing this, 20 years now, every once in a while, I will get this question. Why can't we just spam the spammers to death? Basically, the concept usually revolves around just either automatically replying to every spam or identifying where the spam is coming from and then either sending them a bucket load of email or trying to do some kind of a DDoS attack on them or something like that. This article explains why not only is it a very bad idea, it is also a very ineffective idea. Why can't we just spam the spammers to death? AskLeo.com/13843.
Yep. And I've got a video about scam internet scams, so kind of related to spam. But, you know, I like to, from time to time, remind people about all the different scams out there, because I believe that the best way to protect yourself from scams is to educate yourself ahead of time. Because over and over again, I see the pattern of somebody getting caught up in a scam. And when they, once they're caught up into it, they're kind of locked psychologically into it. It's hard to convince them that they're being scammed. But if they know about the scam ahead of time, it's kind of like a vaccine. You know, you because you knew about it beforehand,
right?
Then the scam is starting to happen, then you recognize it. You know, whereas the other way around doesn't seem to work as well, being told it's a scam when you're already in it. So I run through 10 common internet scams in this video. And I tune it specifically to Apple people, in terms of examples and stuff, but really they're just general online scams that anybody using any technology could benefit from just hearing about these scams. And I go through them pretty quickly. Like, it's a little over, it's about 10 minutes long, and it's 10 different scams, and you know how to recognize them.
Well, it's funny. There's an article or two I think I did just in over the past couple of weeks. There's a podcast I listen to called Hacking Humans, and they basically focus on this kind of stuff, right? How people get fooled. And there have been two cases now where the security experts have themselves fallen for various forms of scams, which gives you an idea of just how slimy and how good sometimes these scammers are at making it look like they're official, they're legit, when they absolutely are not.
And no the one ones,
the ones that always concern me are the romance scams that end up preying on folks who are lonely or isolated or whatever. And those are the ones that I keep hearing over and over again, where they get just a little bit down the path and there's just no convincing them. There is no convincing them that this person doesn't exist or that it's not real or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Often very sad, and often a lot of money gets lost.
Yep. Indeed. All right.
Well, we're back. And then next week, we're not.
We're not.
That's the way it goes. So hopefully that ought to wrap us up for this week. And hopefully we'll see you again in a couple of weeks or so. As always, thanks everyone for listening. And we will see you here again, well, sometime. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Yep. Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/TEH219. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com, and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.